Monday to Friday,
from 9 a.m.
This is Views and News with Clarence Ford.
Only on Cape Talk.
Welcome back, 24 minutes to 10 o'clock, and that big appointment with a naked scientist. Dr. Chris Smith, lecturer at the University of Cambridge, joins us on the line from London. Welcome, Chris. Great to have you.
Good morning, Clarence. How are you?
I'm great, thank you. Sun's shining. We've got Queen Mary II and Queen Victoria, two huge cruise ships docked in the harbour. It looks like summer.
Well, it looks like summer here too, because, and we're doing that traditional thing of starting off talking about the weather, but despite the best efforts of having the wettest winter and the wettest start to the year that I think I can ever remember, we're now having record-breaking warm temperatures. So we're due sort of summer temperatures for the next couple of days before it remembers it's only supposed to be spring and slips back to where it should be. But I shall enjoy those 2 days and make the most of them while we have the African plume, which we're told is responsible for guiding us a bit of warm weather for the next couple of days.
Interesting, but your warm weather is always short-lived. Enjoy it. Enjoy it nonetheless. Okay. It was big news, the solar eclipse this past week, and I expected a question. Henry sends this question to you regarding the solar eclipse. Why did the shadow of the moon move west to east across the Earth when we know the moon rises in the east and sets in the west? Henry, with that question.
Hi, Henry. Well, first of all, what's an eclipse? Well, an eclipse is where the moon gets in front of the sun in the sky between us and our view of the sun and either partially or totally blocks it out. And the reason that it can block it out is by chance, and it is by chance, the moon is the right size in the sky these days to completely cover the disk of the sun. And why do I say these days? Because the moon hasn't always been where it is in the sky. Because of the fact that the Earth is spinning inside the orbit of the Moon, we are giving energy from Earth's rotation to the Moon, so the Earth is slowing down a bit, so days have actually got longer since hundreds of millions of years ago, and the Moon has got a bit more energy, and this has had the effect of pushing the Moon slightly farther away from the Earth. So every year the Moon gets a couple of centimetres farther away from us. When the planet was much younger and the moon was much younger, about 4.5 billion years ago, the moon was very close in. And so we would have had dramatically higher tides. We would have seen a day that was much shorter. We're now in a position where the moon is at that distance away. We have the status quo and we have a moon that is, when we see it, about the same size as the sun. Now, the moon goes around the Earth, lapping us, and it takes a month to complete that journey. So as we turn through our day, because we're rotating inside the orbit of the moon, the moon appears to rise, and this is because as the Earth turns, the moon comes into view, the moon goes across the sky, just like the sun does, and then it sets again. So unsurprisingly, you will get to a situation where as the Earth turns, your view of the moon in relation to the sun is going to change as the day goes on. It's not the moon moving, it's the Earth turning inside the orbit of the moon, and it brings us into a viewpoint eventually where your eyes are lined up with the moon and then lined up with the sun. So you would expect it to move in exactly the way that everyone saw it, which is the moon appears to encroach on the sun, blocks out the sun, and then you see the sun emerge from behind it again. So that's exactly what you'd see. It's because we are turning as a planet inside the orbit of the moon, and therefore our viewpoint is that we're looking across at the sky, seeing the moon appear to move in front of the sun and then a move away from the sun again, because we are standing in a fixed point on the Earth which is turning.
Okay, we're going to go to VJ, and I think we did ask the question sometime last year. It was about achieving ignition, which was an important part of nuclear fusion. But the question reads, Dr. Chris, is there any truth to claims that nuclear fusion may be used to power propulsion engines in the not-too-distant future?
Yes, people are looking at this and a whole raft of other ways that they could harness the power of nuclear fusion. The reason we're interested in it is because nuclear energy does pack a big punch. we know that from, unfortunately, nefarious uses and hostile uses of nuclear energy, but also domestic uses. Nuclear power is a very good way to produce large amounts of energy without having carbon emissions, and to do it over a long period of time. So many people view nuclear energy as one of the ways to solve the energy crisis and our growing demand for energy as a human race into the future. The problem with traditional fission power is that the way in which we extract the energy is that we split nuclear material from big nuclei like uranium into smaller daughter nuclides, and they are very radioactive and they stay radioactive for hundreds of thousands of years. We would much prefer to use the fusion process because we can start with small, simple substances like a heavy form of hydrogen called tritium. And by fusing these materials together to make other less radioactive materials, we do produce a bit of radioactive material, but the half-life, the time it stays bad and dangerous, is much, much shorter. And the infrastructure for nuclear fusion can, we think, be much simpler and less of a blot on the landscape than for fission power, which we're using at the moment. So if we can produce small, extremely energy dense sources of energy, power stations, fusion power stations, we'll be able to deploy them in a range of different places. So people are very interested in using nuclear power as possible sources of not just propulsion in space, but propulsion here on Earth. But it's a question of making it work. And the big problem at the moment is that we know the physics works because the sun runs on nuclear fusion. And in the core of the sun, while it's got plenty of hydrogen there, it is taking four atoms of hydrogen, squeezing them together very hard, and out pops an atom of helium and associated energy, because there's a bit of missing mass. The four atoms of hydrogen weigh slightly less than the atom of helium, and that missing mass is the energy that the sun then radiates to us. The sun does it because it's absolutely huge. You could pack the Earth inside the sun about a million times over, and it's very hot. So in the centre, where it's millions of degrees and the pressure is enormous, you can make fusion happen. We've got to try to recreate the conditions of a star like the sun here on the Earth's surface and do it in a compact way that isn't a million times bigger than we are. And that is what physicists and engineers are grappling with at the moment and finding various clever ways to do that. And if we can, then we will be able to use this as a source of energy to do things like power spacecraft in space, lunar bases on the moon's surface, and even, who knows, weapons of the future as well, unfortunately.
Absolutely. I'm as excited about that, Vijay, as you are. And maybe you want to read up on nuclear fusion as well and developments on that front. We have a voice note in for the Naked Scientist. Let's take a listen, Joe.
Hi, Dr. Chris Smith. This is Logan here from Edenvale in Joburg. I just wanted to know, when babies are born, their lungs can absorb oxygen from water. Is it not possible that we could actually keep that going and, you know, as an adult person still be able to extract oxygen out of fluid? Is it a possibility that we could actually evolve ourselves to that if we kept on doing it when we were young?
Hi, Logan. Well, you're referring to respiration through a fluid. And people have explored this. And I think it was made famous in the film The Abyss, wasn't it? Where it was pointed out that people couldn't dive at the huge extreme depths and pressures with normal gas equipment. So they had to have a fluid, because fluids are incompressible. So if you have an oxygen-charged fluid that you then push into the lungs, that could deliver the oxygen into the person's bloodstream. People have explored this scientifically. Very hard to make it work, though. And the reason is it's all about scale and size. The reason the lungs work the way they do and they're adapted the way they are is that gases are very low density. They have low resistance to flow. And when you push gas in and out of your lungs, you can move a lot of it quite quickly and it's quite easy to make it move. And so you pull the gas in, you bring the gas into contact with a layer of moisture around the air sacs, the alveoli in the lungs, and the short distance between where the gas is and where tiny blood vessels are, which are forming a dense web around each of those air sacs, means the oxygen can move from the air sac into the blood, and carbon dioxide, which is in the blood, can move out of the blood into the air sac, and you can then breathe it out. Moving a fluid, because it's much heavier and it's much denser, and there's a lot more resistance to flow. You're talking about tiny blood vessels, the terminal bronchioles, which are down at the 20th generation of divisions of the airways and so on, and beyond. Those are minute. And the fluid, the drag of trying to move fluid in and out of those is really extraordinarily high. And there's a good reason that when a baby's born, it gets squeezed out of a very tight hole normally, and then it coughs up the residuum of the fluid that was in its lungs, because you can't respire properly, you can't breathe properly with lungs full of fluid. And this is why people drown. So it's a tantalising aspiration that we could, if you excuse the pun, aspiration rather than respiration. It's a tantalising idea that we could try to breathe with the fluid, and that would make certain circumstances easier for us as humans to access. But it's so difficult to do this that largely the best technologists have given up and said, let's leave it in the realms of Hollywood. It's just not going to work for us humans.
Question in from Sydney for the Naked Scientist, please. According to Newton's laws of physics, to every force there is an equal and opposite force. What is the opposite force to gravity?
Right, well, Newton's third law, which is what's being referred to here, is that for every action, there's an equal and opposite reaction. So in other words, Clarence, if I push on you, you push me back. Specifically, if I reach out and push on the wall doesn't move, but my hand can feel I'm pushing the wall. And this is because I'm compressing the particles in the wall, and the particles in the wall are compressing the particles in my finger. And the force that my finger feels is equivalent to the force that the wall feels. So it's not that there's a force that exists and then another one has to exist to balance it. It is that for an entity on which a force is acting, there is an equal and opposite force. So when gravity is pulling me down into the chair I'm sitting on, then I am pushing on the floor because gravity is pulling me towards the center of the earth, but the floor is pushing up on me. So basically my bum feels the same force that the chair is feeling from my bum, and everyone's a winner, as it were.
Gotcha. So Sydney, you're not going to be able to fly just yet. But this, I think, is a very, very interesting and really deep question from Anne. It reads, Dr. Chris, this is a question of great scientific importance. If a fly falls into my glass of wine and I take the fly out quite quickly, does the alcohol in the wine kill the yucky stuff from the fly so that I can still drink the wine safely?
Now, this is probably the most important question of the year. I don't know about the day. Will it spoil your Shiraz? Well, look, it depends what the fly has got on it, because what's being referred to here is the sterilizing effect of alcohol. And alcohol is actually a very good sterilizant. We go to the hospital, we use alcohol hand gel often to cleanse our hands when we're seeing our patients or when we have visitors to come and see people in hospital, because by and large, alcohol is a really good way of destroying a whole host of different microorganisms. And the reason it does this is alcohol will disrupt the oily layers that surround cells, and bacteria have a cell wall, and alcohol can disrupt that and destroy the bacteria. Also, some viruses have an envelope or an oily bag around the outside of the virus, and alcohol will destroy that as well. Not all viruses do, though, and some viruses are just a hard protein husk, and the dreaded norovirus that causes diarrhea and vomiting very prolifically, and millions of cases in every country every single year, whether we realise it or not, are down to norovirus. That is not deactivated by alcohol, and certainly not at the concentration of alcohol you have in your wine glass, because that's the other consideration, that most wines have between 12 and 14% alcohol. Most hand gels that we use to sterilize surfaces have up to 70% alcohol in them. So I think you have two problems here. One is that there are going to be some microbes which are resistant to alcohol because they're made of things alcohol can't dismantle. That's the first problem. And the second is the concentration of alcohol in your beverage is probably going to be so low that if there were sufficient microorganisms on the feet of the fly that it put them into your wine, they wouldn't necessarily be deactivated. Is it likely that the fly is going to have an infectious dose of something on it? Well, it's not impossible, but it's also not that likely either. So the chances are, if you hooked the fly out quick, A, you're going to have probably a drunk fly, because flies do get drunk, and the alcohol will have an effect on the fly's nervous system in a similar way to the way it affects ours. It will also affect the fly's chemistry quite badly, so it won't come off too well, at least initially. But is it going to pose a major threat to you? I think the likelihood is really, really remote. But for the reasons I've outlined, you can never say never.
Strangely enough, there's another question in about whiskey and the fly.
Well, whiskey is 40 to 50% alcohol, and this is getting much closer to the realms of concentration that would deactivate microorganisms. You can use alcohol at that sort of concentration to do a reasonably good job at sterilizing things. So if I had to lay my life on the line about which was going to be more likely to be sterile after an encounter with the fly, I'd say whiskey rather than wine.
Gotcha. I have a question for Dr. Chris. What is the difference between cancer and non-cancerous growth? What are fibroids, or can some fibroids be cancerous?
Right. Well, cancer is a very specific diagnosis. A cancer is a population of cells which, because their DNA has been damaged, lose the ability to obey the normal instructions and constraints and restrictions on growth. So they grow out of control, and they can spread to other parts of the body and do the same. And they also don't obey the normal instructions that would regulate what genes are turned on or off. So they can make anything that your DNA knows how to make. And by rearranging their DNA, which they can also do, they can make other stuff that your DNA currently doesn't normally make. And they splurge all of these chemicals out into the bloodstream and produce a whole raft of what we call paraneoplastic syndromes as well, symptoms which are caused by metabolic disturbance because of the cancer doing other things that it shouldn't. So cancer is a very specific disease where cells left to their own devices would ultimately cause destruction locally as well as distant sites in the body. Now that's in contrast to benign growths, where cells may have some of the same characteristics of cancer. They may have changed some of the same genes that enable cancers to grow, but they don't disobey the normal rules, so they don't depart from where they start. They usually don't grow intrusively through other tissues. They may produce a pressure on the tissue locally, which can have long-term effects. And so, for instance, some brain tumours like meningiomas, which grow in the linings around the brain, they're not cancer because they are not growing in an invasive way, but their sheer physical presence over time, because they get bigger and bigger, can put pressure on things that can have consequences. So it's not to say that a benign tumor is always benign. Ultimately, it can have consequences, but some growths do use the same growth mechanisms as cancer, but they still obey the normal rules to an extent, so they don't spread to other parts of the body, and they often don't grow as quickly as cancer, and they often, usually, don't produce these other rafts of chemicals that can get into the bloodstream and then start to subvert the normal role of other tissues like cancer, these so-called paraneoplastic effects. References made to fibroids, these are growths in the wall of the uterus, the womb. And they are very common, and they get more common with age, and they can cause things like heavy periods or painful periods, and they definitely need investigating. Sometimes they can convert themselves into more aggressive growths, and they can turn into forms of cancer, but compared to how many people have fibroids and the fact they can be easily remedied, the risk of that happening is relatively low, but you can never say never in medicine. So if someone finds something like that, you would always investigate properly to make sure that it hasn't transitioned into something nasty or isn't driven by something nasty masquerading as something more benign.
Question in from Lucy. Do iTerra care machines actually work? They use terahertz waves to heal injuries and improve blood flow. I don't see how it could possibly work, but I'm interested to find out.
I don't know anything about this technology, so if you have a reference or Lucy, you'd like to drop me a line, it's chris@thenakedscientist.com. I will take a look and see what the evidence base is behind what they're claiming.
Okay, we have 2 minutes left. Time for that last WhatsApp voice note. Joe, let's take a listen.
Hi, question for Dr. Chris. I need to find out, with regards to lactose intolerance, so do breast milk have lactose in it? And then if breast milk have lactose, how come the mother who has breast milk does not get lactose intolerance from her own breast milk? And then you'll find children who are lactose intolerant at a very young age, I think 1 or 2 years, but all along they've had breast milk for some time. Why are they not having lactose intolerant as well?
We've got a couple of seconds for that answer.
Yeah, what a terrific question, though. Lactose is a sugar, and it's strongly represented in milk and human breast milk is a form of milk, and so it's in there. But the reason we get lactose intolerance is because we make various genes switch on when we're little, which can break down lactose and can put it into our bloodstream, and that's how we get energy and nutrition. As we get older, we lose that ability, and we also lose some of the bacteria that break this stuff down. And lactose intolerance is referring to the gastrointestinal side effects of drinking a lot of lactose-containing milk usually, but other foods can do it too, because we, as adults, lack the ability to digest that material. But children do have that. Babies have high levels of this, and because they have high levels of it, they can tolerate milk. The problem is that they then lose that ability as they get older some of the time, and those people are destined to get lactose intolerance. The mother is just secreting the milk from glandular tissue in the breast into the ducts in the breast and then giving it to the baby. So it's not going into her intestine, so she isn't suffering the symptoms of lactose intolerance by making the milk.
And we thank you for your time, for your answers. And your patience, Dr. Chris Smith, the Naked Scientist, every Friday just after 9:30. It is the place right here on Cape Talk where your questions are answered.